when German Chancellor Angela Merkel stood before cheering crowds at the Brandenburg Gate during the 2014 World Cup celebrations, she embodied a nation that has transformed itself from Europe's greatest threat into its stabilizing anchor. Neil McGregor's Germany, Memories of a Nation offers a fascinating window into this remarkable evolution. Unlike traditional histories that present triumphant narratives, McGregor's work acknowledges Germany's unique relationship with its past, one where monuments commemorate not just victories, but also national shame. Oprah Winfrey called it the most illuminating exploration of national identity I've ever encountered, while The Guardian declared it essential reading for anyone who wants to understand the complex forces that have shaped modern Europe. Through objects, architecture, and cultural touchstones, McGregor reveals how Germany has turned its fractured history into a source of strength, creating a nation that constantly revisits its past to shape a better future. Germany's monuments tell a fundamentally different story than those of other European powers, reflecting a distinctive approach to historical memory. While Paris's Arc de Triomphe and London's Marble Arch celebrate unalloyed national victories and imperial might, Munich's Siegestor bears a striking dual narrative that epitomizes Germany's complex relationship with its past. Its north side glorifies Bavarian military valor with classical reliefs of charging cavalry and victorious commanders, but its bomb-damaged south side, deliberately left unrestored after World War II, carries the sobering inscription, "Dedicated to victory, destroyed by war, urging peace." This architectural honesty extends beyond mere symbolism to become a physical manifestation of national reflection. Four profound traumas have indelibly shaped German collective memory and national consciousness. The devastating 30 Years' War, 1618 to 1648, which killed nearly a third of the German population and ravaged the countryside. Napoleon's humiliating occupation, 1806 to 1812, which dissolved the Holy Roman Empire and reorganized German territories. The Third Reich's unprecedented crimes against humanity, and Germany's post-war division into East and West, which literally split families and communities. Unlike nations that construct reassuring historical narratives or minimize darker chapters, Germany has embraced what historians call Vergangenheitsbewältigung, the ongoing process of coming to terms with the past. This history is so damaged that it cannot be repaired, but rather must be constantly revisited through education, art, and public spaces. The Brandenburg Gate in Berlin stands as perhaps the most powerful embodiment of this historical approach. Originally built in the 1780s by Frederick William II as a neoclassical monument to peace, the gate was deliberately modeled after the Propylaea, the entrance to the Athenian Acropolis, signaling Berlin's aspirations as an Athens-like cultural center. Its subsequent history mirrors Germany's turbulent path. Napoleon marched through it triumphantly after defeating Prussia in 1806 and removed its crowning bronze quadriga to Paris as war booty. 8 years later, after Prussia helped defeat Napoleon, the quadriga returned to Berlin, modified with the addition of the Prussian eagle and Iron Cross, transforming the gate from a symbol of peace into one of victory over French occupation. During the Cold War, the gate took on even greater symbolic significance. It became the ultimate boundary between East and West Berlin, closed for 28 years after the Berlin Wall's construction in 1961. Its reopening in December 1989 marked a pivotal moment in German reunification. Today, it serves multiple roles, as Germany's communal gathering place for national celebrations, a tourist attraction, and most importantly, a physical reminder of Germany's commitment to remember rather than erase difficult chapters of its past. This approach extends to other monuments like the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe near the Brandenburg Gate, the Documentation Center for the History of Nazi Socialism in Munich, and countless Stolpersteine, stumbling stones, embedded in sidewalks throughout German cities to commemorate victims of Nazi persecution. What other nation so consistently erects monuments to its own shame and historical misdeeds to ensure the future will be different? two cities that were once vital German cultural centers but are no longer German-speaking, Prague, now Praha, and Königsberg, now Kaliningrad, represent phantom limbs of German cultural memory. These places, once integral to German identity, have been separated by history and politics, but remain crucial to understanding Germany's complex past. Prague, home to Charles University, founded 1348, was the first German-speaking university and remains central to German intellectual history, despite now being Czech. Similarly, Königsberg in the east was the birthplace of philosopher Immanuel Kant, who famously never traveled more than 10 miles from his hometown, yet became foundational to German and European philosophy. Founded violently in 1254 by the Teutonic Knights, Königsberg became the easternmost outpost of the German-speaking world. The region grew wealthy through trade, particularly in amber, fossilized resin harvested from Baltic shores and more precious than silver. The city's remoteness proved politically advantageous, allowing Frederick III, Elector of Brandenburg, to crown himself king in Prussia there in 1701 without requiring the emperor's permission. After World War II, Königsberg was devastated by bombing and artillery. The German population was killed or deported, replaced by Soviet citizens. Renamed Kaliningrad, it became a Soviet naval base where nearly all traces of German heritage were erased. In 1947, the Allied Control Council formally abolished Prussia by law, declaring it the seat of reaction and militarism, an unprecedented act of eliminating a state by an act of the pen. Prague's German history followed a different trajectory. Germans first came by invitation in the 13th century, and by 1300, Prague had a distinct German quarter. When Emperor Rudolf II established his residence there around 1600, it became the intellectual capital of the German world. Franz Kafka, born in 1883, experienced the city's transition from German to Czech dominance firsthand. As both a German speaker and a Jew in an increasingly Czech and Catholic city, Kafka embodied the outsider perspective that defines his literature. By his death in 1924, German speakers comprised only 5% of Prague's population, most of them Jewish. After the Holocaust and the 1945 expulsion of 3 million German speakers from Czechoslovakia, the 700-year German presence in Prague ended. Today, both cities maintain connections with Germany through tourism and trade, with Kaliningrad's university now named after Kant, reminders that while Germany's political boundaries are fixed, its cultural consciousness extends beyond modern borders. In the aftermath of World War II, exiled writer Thomas Mann declared the German language his true homeland, wahre Heimat, even as physical Germany lay in ruins. This sentiment echoed Bavarian King Ludwig I's earlier turn to language as the defining element of German identity after Napoleon's humiliation of the Holy Roman Empire. The remarkable unity of written German across widely varying dialects is largely attributable to one man, Martin Luther. Luther's 95 Theses began as a theological protest against the church selling indulgences to finance St. Peter's in Rome. Though initially written in Latin for scholarly debate, friends translated them into German and had them printed. With over 3,000 printing shops across Germany and Central Europe, Luther's idea spread rapidly before the church could respond. When summoned before Emperor Charles V at the Diet of Worms in 1521 and ordered to recant, Luther allegedly declared, "Here I stand, I can do no other." Declared a heretic and outlaw, Luther found protection in Germany's fragmented political landscape when the Elector of Saxony sheltered him at Wartburg Castle. In the solitude of Wartburg Castle, Luther completed his German New Testament in just 11 weeks. The Archbishop of Mainz had claimed German was too coarse for Scripture, but Luther was determined to create a language both worthy of God's Word and accessible to ordinary Germans. His translation revolutionized German writing by modeling it on spoken language. As Luther explained in his 1530 open letter on translation, he didn't ask Latin literature how to speak German, but listened to the mother at home, the children in the street, the common man in the market. Luther's Bible sold 500,000 copies in his lifetime, remarkable given Germany's fragmented linguistic landscape. His translation created a compromise language understandable everywhere, with everyday idioms and folk sayings that spread internationally within months. The combination of the printing press, the historical stage of German language development, and the Reformation's theological revolution created a perfect storm with Luther as catalyst. Today, Germans unknowingly use Luther's words and phrases daily. Sündenbock, scapegoat, and Herzenslust are just two examples. Luther also created German to be sung, beginning the chorale tradition for congregational singing. His influence extended to Johann Sebastian Bach, who absorbed Luther's rhythms as a boy chorister in Eisenach's Gergenkirche, later incorporating them into his cantatas, oratorios, and passions. Through his revolutionary translation, Luther gave Germans a unified language that would become the foundation of their national identity. The Brothers Grimm's fairy tales, Rapunzel, Snow White, Hansel and Gretel, are not merely children's stories, but reflections of German national identity forged in the forest. The dark woods where these tales unfold mirror the Teutoburg Forest, site of Hermann's legendary victory over Rome in AD 9, a battle that kept Germany unconquered and established the Rhine as the Roman frontier. In the early 1800s, as Napoleon's France occupied Germany and dismantled the Holy Roman Empire, literature and painting created a sense of Germanness through forest imagery as resistance to foreign aggression. The Grimm brothers' Kinder und Hausmärchen, Children's and Household Tales, first published in 1812 as resistance to Napoleon-gathered strength, remains in almost every German home. Yet the Grimms weren't merely collecting children's stories. They were obsessed with the German language itself. As pioneering linguists who formulated Grimm's Law on sound change between languages, they saw German's ancient roots as evidence of national identity that no invader could erase. The forest appears as powerfully in German painting as in literature. Caspar David Friedrich's Der einsame Baum, The Solitary Tree, from 1822, features a lone oak, battered yet leafy, dominating the composition while sheltering a shepherd and flock. The oak symbolized German resilience, having survived all sorts of hardship. Just as the Teutoburg Forest had aided Hermann against the Romans, freedom fighters against Napoleon used forest cover. The oak tree emerged as a powerful German symbol of survival and rebirth, appearing on the Iron Cross in 1813 and later on post-1945 coins. Friedrich's paintings show sublime trees and landscapes where individuals discover their potential alongside the nation, representing the German soul in nature. While Friedrich painted sublime trees, the Grimms portrayed threatening forests, both effectively inventing the German landscape that would later be physically created through 19th century reforestation. Both Friedrich and the Grimms helped re-establish German identity after Napoleon's destruction of the Holy Roman Empire. Their work was later appropriated by nationalists and Nazis before being reclaimed, the Grimms by modern German families, and Friedrich as an eco-warrior defending the countryside. Through forest imagery, Germans found a cultural identity that could withstand political fragmentation and foreign occupation, a resilient sense of self rooted in nature rather than politics. If Americans are one nation under God, Germans are one nation under Goethe. The instantly recognizable portrait of Goethe in Italy by Johann Tischbein shows the writer who, along with his masterpiece Faust, has become a defining element of German national identity. Alongside Luther's language and shared memories of fairy tales, Goethe stands as the greatest German poet who made German a language respected throughout educated Europe. Born to a prosperous family in Frankfurt in 1749, Goethe rebelled during his university years, pursuing poetry instead of law. Finding conventional literary German too stilted and French-influenced, Goethe discovered in Shakespeare a model for expressing authentic German thoughts and raw emotions. In 1771, the 22-year-old Goethe organized Germany's first Shakespeare celebration, delivering a passionate speech that Anne Bonenkamp Rankin describes as a kind of religious awakening that showed Goethe a new, free way to write, think, and live. Under Shakespeare's influence, Goethe wrote his first major work, The Sorrows of Young Werther, 1774, a revolutionary novel that became a European sensation. This story of unrequited love ending in suicide shocked readers yet established German as a European literary language. Young men everywhere dressed like Werther in blue coats and yellow waistcoats, and Napoleon famously carried the book to Egypt. At 37, experiencing what we might now call a midlife crisis, Goethe traveled to Rome, where he met the artist Tischbein, who painted his famous portrait. The painting shows Goethe reclining among Roman ruins with a small German oak growing nearby, symbolizing how he would create something living from these fragments of ancient culture. Throughout his life, Goethe worked on Faust, the drama of a man who makes a pact with the devil to explore the world, striving ceaselessly to understand and enjoy, doing both good and evil. Since its publication from 1808 onwards, Faust has been intertwined with German identity. As Anne Bonenkamp Rankin explains, interpretations have shifted with the times, from symbol of national energy in the 19th century, to Nazi emblem of German striving and success, to communist vision of society, to today's more nuanced reading of a broken figure bearing both guilt and ambition. For critic Gustav Seibt, Goethe now represents something beyond Faust. He embodies multicultural Germany. German Muslims find connection through his West-Eastern Divan poems, where Goethe acknowledges Allah and Muhammad. Today's Germans see in Goethe a model for managing life's challenges, overcoming depression, fears, and neuroses to live productively. Tischbein's portrait, prophetically showing Goethe as monumental, has indeed become Germany's monument, even greeting travelers at Frankfurt Airport as a statue, the symbol of Germany past and present. While Ludwig's Valhalla never became a strong focus of popular national sentiment, he inadvertently created a more accessible symbol of German identity, the Munich October Festival. Started in 1810 to celebrate his wedding, it's now the world's largest festival. Germans have been enthusiastic beer drinkers for at least 2,000 years. Tacitus noted their fondness for fermented grain drinks around AD 100, and archaeological evidence confirms this ancient tradition. The Bavarian Reinheitsgebot, beer purity law, of 1487, was designed to preserve grain for bread during times of scarcity by preventing brewing with wheat or rye. Its symbolic importance in German identity was so powerful that Bavaria made its adoption a condition for joining the German Empire in 1871. Regional beers define German localities, from Franconia's handmade brews to Bamberg's distinctive Rauchbier, smoke beer, and Munich's Augustiner beer, originally made by monks. German sausages, like beer, embody centuries of regional history and local pride. With an estimated 1,200 varieties, a Wurst map of Germany would show incredible complexity, from Bavaria's Weisswurst, a delicate white veal sausage never eaten afternoon, to Nuremberger's, finger-sized sausages containing expensive spices from Venice, and the once prestigious Frankfurter, originally a luxury created for imperial coronations. Even the humble Rindswurst from Frankfurt reflects cultural history, created as a beef sausage for the city's large Jewish population who couldn't eat pork. The Currywurst, Berlin's iconic street food, emerged from post-war necessity when an unknown British soldier sold curry powder on the black market in late 1940s Berlin. Berliners used the exotic spice to mask the flavor of cheap sausages, creating what food expert Harald Scholl calls a gourmet tragedy that nonetheless became emblematic of Berlin's cool lifestyle after reunification. Though beer consumption has declined, Germany remains the world's third largest consumer, with local varieties still dominant. After decades when beer and sausages were avoided for their nationalist associations, younger generations have reclaimed these traditions without the jingoistic baggage. The October Festival exemplifies this shift. 20 years ago, few would wear traditional Bavarian costume, but today everyone does so without nationalist overtones. As food writer Peter notes, the festival has become a symbol of German hospitality that brings people and peoples together more even than football. Germany's gastronomic diversity, with its countless regional beers and sausages, mirrors its political structure throughout history. Just as the Holy Roman Empire held together diverse territories for a millennium despite enormous local variations, Germany's food traditions represent centuries of regional history contained within overarching national frameworks. By 1945, Germany had murdered over 11 million people in Europe, including 6 million Jews, seemingly ending centuries of Jewish presence in Germany. Yet remarkably, Germany today has Western Europe's fastest-growing Jewish population, numbering several hundred thousand. Rabbi Mendel Gurewitz, who moved from the U.S. to Frankfurt in the late 1990s, explains, "If we decide because of Hitler that Jews shouldn't be here anymore, we are going to do what Hitler wanted to do. I think we should do the opposite." For centuries before the Holocaust, Germany had treated its Jewish population with more tolerance than many Western European countries. While local crises sometimes led to expulsions, Germany's political fragmentation meant Jewish communities could always find refuge somewhere. By the 18th century, many princes actively encouraged Jewish settlement. Moses Mendelssohn, who entered Berlin in 1743 when a guard logged 6 oxen, 7 pigs, and 1 Jew, became known as the German Socrates and translated the Pentateuch into German, leading a Jewish Enlightenment that challenged Orthodox traditions. Despite the Frankfurt ghetto's restrictions, Germany's Jews were sometimes better treated than other minorities. The Rothschild banking empire was established in the Judengasse by Mayor Amschel Rothschild in the 1760s. His 5 sons expanded the business across Europe, financing governments during the Napoleonic Wars. By the early 20th century, German Jews had achieved significant integration, exemplified by the Grand Offenbach Synagogue, built in 1916 at the symbolic junction of Goethestrasse and Kaiserstrasse. Yet this apparent paradise was fragile. That same year saw the Judensalem, counting of Jews, amid unfounded claims they were avoiding military service. After the Holocaust, a small Jewish community emerged in Offenbach, composed mainly of Polish survivors who never expected to stay permanently. Hermann Zvi Goodman designed their modest synagogue around 1950, deliberately positioned at the back of its site, almost hidden from view. As Rabbi Mendel Gurewitz explained, "No one wanted to stay here, but it was the idea of some of the people who lived here in Offenbach, we need to build a synagogue, at least for now." Everything changed after the Soviet collapse in 1990, when Helmut Kohl offered immediate asylum and financial assistance to Soviet Jews. 200,000 Jews moved to Germany, many choosing it over Israel because of the climate and generous German support. The Offenbach community grew dramatically, requiring architect Alfred Jacobi to expand the synagogue. His design deliberately faced the city, removing the fence they had been hiding behind to make it a civic building within the context of the whole city again. The new complex includes an interreligious kindergarten with equal parts Muslim, Christian, and Jewish children. 70 years after the Holocaust, hundreds of thousands of Jews have chosen to leave Eastern Europe and settle in Germany, a remarkable historical irony that the synagogue's evolution from hidden refuge to proud civic building perfectly symbolizes. Our journey through Germany's past ends at the Reichstag, seat of the German parliament, just a couple hundred yards from where we began at the Brandenburg Gate. Both buildings carry Germany's political history in their stones and have been repeatedly reshaped by historical events. Though once separated by the Berlin Wall, today tourists stroll easily between them, puzzling over where the Cold War boundary once stood. The area surrounding the Reichstag is dotted with memorials to Nazi victims, most prominently the Holocaust Memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe, alongside more modest monuments to disabled people, homosexuals, and the Sinti and Roma. These memorials, deliberately placed where parliamentarians must pass them daily, represent Germany's unique commitment to painful self-recollection. As Christopher Clark notes, the guilt is internalized and becomes part of the German national identity, a self-critical awareness unparalleled in other nations. The Reichstag building itself reflects Germany's turbulent political journey. Built in the 1880s as the Grand Parliament of the new German Empire, it was initially undermined by Bismarck and the Kaiser, who resisted its democratic implications. Even its facade inscription, Dem Deutschen Volke, for the German people, faced imperial opposition. The building witnessed the proclamation of the Weimar Republic in 1918, then the infamous 1933 fire that gave Hitler pretext to suspend constitutional rights. Severely damaged in World War II, the Reichstag became the symbolic target for Soviet forces, who planted their flag on its roof in May 1945. After decades of neglect near the Berlin Wall, the Reichstag underwent a remarkable transformation following reunification. In 1995, artists Christo and Jean-Claude wrapped the entire building in silver fabric, allowing Germans to reimagine it free from its troubled past. Norman Foster's subsequent renovation preserved the building's battle scars while adding a transparent glass dome where citizens can literally look down upon their representatives, a powerful architectural metaphor for democratic oversight. As Culture Minister Monika Grütters observed, the cupola is an inviting place where visitors can walk above the chamber. At last, the words "to the German people" have taken on their real meaning. The Reichstag exemplifies how Berlin dreams in architecture, continually reinventing itself while acknowledging its past. From the Brandenburg Gate's Athenian aspirations to Museum Island's Parnassus on the Spree, the city's buildings reflect Germany's historical self-conception as heirs to Greek civilization. The contested site of the Staatsschloss, demolished by the GDR and now being rebuilt, will house art collections from Africa, Asia, Oceania, and the Americas, transforming a symbol of Prussian militarism into one of global cultural dialogue. This architectural transformation mirrors Germany's broader evolution, a nation that has turned its fractured, difficult past into a source of strength by confronting rather than denying it. In doing so, Germany has created a new kind of patriotism based not on triumphalism but on honest reckoning, a model for how nations might constructively engage with their most painful chapters to build a more humane future.